This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Gwendy's Final Task, a novel by Stephen King and Richard Chismar. Read by Marin Ireland.
For Marcia DeFilippo, a friend to a couple of writers. Chapter 1. It's a beautiful April day in Playa Linda, Florida, not far from Cape Canaveral. This is the year of our Lord 2026, and only a few of the people in the crowd standing on the east side of Max Hokeback Creek are wearing masks. Most of those are old people who got into the habit and find it hard to break. The coronavirus is still around, like a party guest who won't go home, and while many fear it may mutate again and render the vaccines useless, for now it's been fought to a draw. Some members of the crowd, again it's mostly the oldies, the ones whose eyesight isn't as good as it once was, are using binoculars, but most are not. The craft standing on the Playa Linda launch pad is the biggest manned rocket ever to lift off for Mother Earth. With a fully loaded mass of 4.57 million pounds, it has every right to be called Eagle 19 Heavy. A fog of vapor obscures the last 50 of its 400-foot height, but even those with fading vision can read the three letters running down the spacecraft's side, T-E-T. And those with even fair hearing can pick up the applause when it begins. One man, old enough to remember hearing Neil Armstrong's crackling voice telling the world that the Eagle had landed, turns to his wife with tears in his eyes and goosebumps on his tanned, scrawny arms. The old man is Douglas Dusty Brigham. His wife is Sheila Brigham. They retired to the town of Destin 10 years ago, but they are originally from Castle Rock, Maine. Sheila, in fact, was once the dispatcher in the sheriff's office. From the Tet Corporation's launch facility a mile and a half away, the applause continues. To Dusty and Sheila, it sounds thin, but it must be much louder across the creek, because herons arise from their morning's resting place in a lacy white cloud. They're on their way, Dusty tells his wife of 52 years.
God bless our girl, Sheila says and crosses herself. God bless our Gwendy.
Chapter 2. 8 men and 2 women walk in a line along the right side of the Tet Control Center. They are protected by a plexiglass wall because they've been in quarantine for the last 12 days. The techs rise from behind their computers and applaud. That much is tradition, but today there's also cheering. There will be more applause and cheers from the 1,500 Tet employees. The patches on their shirts, jackets, and coveralls identify them as the Tet Rocket Jockeys outside. Any manned space mission is an event, but this one is extra special. Second from the end of the line is a woman with her long hair, now gray, tied back in a ponytail that's mostly hidden beneath the high collar of her pressure suit. Her face is unwrinkled and still beautiful, although there are fine lines around her eyes and at the corners of her mouth. Her name is Gwendy Peterson. She's 64. And in less than an hour, she will be the first sitting U.S. senator to ride a rocket to the new MF-1 space station. There are cynics among Gwendy's political peers who like to say MF stands for a certain incestuous sex act, but it actually stands for many flags. The crew are carrying their helmets for the time being, so 9 of them have a free hand to wave, acknowledging the cheers. Gwendy, technically a crew member, can't wave unless she wants to wave the small white case in her other hand. And she doesn't want to do that. Instead of waving, she calls, "We love you and thank you. This is one more step to the stars." The cheers and applause redouble. Someone yells, "Gwendy for president!" A few others take up the call, but not that many. She's popular, but not that popular. Especially not in Florida, which went red, again, in the last general election. The crew leaves the building and climbs into the 3-car tram that will take them to Eagle Heavy. Gwendy has to crane her neck all the way to the reinforced collar of her suit to see the top of the rocket. Am I really going up in that? She asks herself, and not for the first time. In the seat next to her, the team's tall, sandy-haired biologist leans toward her. He speaks in a low murmur.
There's still time to back out. No one would think the worse of you.
Gwendy laughs. It comes out nervy and too shrill. If you believe that, you must also believe in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy.
Fair enough, he says. But never mind what people would think. If you have any idea, any at all, that you're going to freak out and start yelling, "Wait, stop, I've changed my mind," when the engines light up, then call it off now. Because once those engines go, there's no turning around and no one needs a panicked politician on board. Or a panicky billionaire, for that matter.
He looks to the car ahead of them, where a man is bending the ear of the ops commander. In his white pressure suit, the man bears a resemblance to the Pillsbury Doughboy. The 3-car tram starts to roll. Men and women in coveralls applaud them on their way. Gwendy puts the white case down and holds it firmly between her feet. Now she can wave. I'll be fine. She's not entirely sure of that, but tells herself she has to be. Has to. Because of the white case. Stamped in raised red letters on both sides are the words classified material. How about you? The bio guy smiles, and Gwendy realizes that she can't remember his name. He's been her training partner for the last 4 weeks. Only minutes ago, they back-checked each other's suits before leaving the holding area, but she can't remember his name. This is NG, as her late mother would have said. Not good.
I'll be fine. This'll be my 3rd trip, and when the rocket starts to climb and I feel the G-force pressing down, speaking just for myself, it's the best orgasm a boy ever had.
Thank you for sharing, Gwendy says. I'll be sure to put it in my first dispatch to the down below. It's what they call Earth, the down below. She remembers that. But what's Bio Boy's damn name? In the pocket of her jumper, she's got a notebook with all sorts of info in it, not to mention a very special bookmark. The names of all the crew members are in there, but no way can she get at the notebook now. And even if she could, it might, almost certainly would, raise suspicions. Gwendy falls back on the technique Dr. Ambrose gave her. It doesn't always work, but this time, it does. The man next to her is tall, square-jawed, blue-eyed, and has a tumble of sandy hair. The women think he's hot. What's hot? Fire's hot. If you touch it, you might get a burn. That's his name. Burn Stapleton. Professor Burn Stapleton, who also happens to be Major Burn Stapleton, retired.
Please don't,
Burn says. She's pretty sure he's talking about his orgasm metaphor. There's nothing wrong with her short-term memory, at least not so far. Well, not too wrong. I was joking, Gwendy says, and pats his gloved hand with her own. And stop worrying, Burn, I'll be fine. She tells herself again that she must be. She doesn't want to let down her constituents, and today that's all of America and most of the world, but that's minor compared to the locked white box between her boots. She can't let it down, because there's a box inside the box, made not of high-impact steel, but of mahogany. It's a foot wide, a bit more than that in length, and about 7 inches deep. There are buttons on top, and levers so small you have to pull them with your pinky finger on either side. They have just one paying passenger on this flight to the MF, and it's not Gwendy. She has an actual job. Not much of one, mostly just recording data on her iPad and sending it back to Tet Control, but it's not entirely a cover for her real business in the up above. She's a climate monitor. Her call designation is Weather Girl, and some of the crew jokingly refers to her as Tempest Storm, the name of a long-ago ecdysiast. What is that? She asks herself. I should know. Because she doesn't, she resorts to Dr. Ambrose's technique again. The word she's looking for is like paint, isn't it? No, not paint. Before you paint, you have to get rid of the old paint. You have to strip, she murmurs.
What?
Byrne asks. He has been distracted by a bunch of applauding men standing beside one of the emergency trucks, which, please God, won't have to roll on this fine spring day.
Nothing, she says, thinking, an ecdysiast is a stripper.
It's always a relief when the missing words come. She knows that all too soon they won't.
She doesn't like that, is in fact terrified of it. But that's the future. Right now, she just has to get through today. Once she's up there, where the air is not just rare but non-existent, they can't just send her home if they discover what's wrong with her, can they?
But they could screw up her mission if they found out.
And there's something else.
Something that would be even worse. Gwendy doesn't want to even think about it but can't help herself.
What if she forgets the real reason she's up there? The real reason is the box inside the box. It sounds melodramatic, but Gwendy Peterson knows it's true. The fate of the world depends on what's inside that box. Chapter 3. The service and delivery structure beside Eagle Heavy is a crisscross latticework of steel beams housing a huge open elevator. Gwendy and her fellow travelers mount the 9 stairs and get inside. The elevator has a capacity of 36, and there's plenty of room to spread out. But Gareth Winston stands next to her, his considerable belly pooching out the front of his white pressure suit. Winston is her least favorite person on this trip to the up above, although she has every confidence he doesn't know it. Over a quarter century in politics has taught Gwendy the fine art of hiding her feelings and putting on a you're so darn fascinating face. When she was first elected to the House of Representatives, a political veteran named Patricia Patsy Follett took Gwendy under her wing and gave her some valuable advice. That particular day, it was about an old buzzard from Mississippi named Milton Jackson, long since gone to that great caucus room in the sky. But Gwendy's found it useful ever since. Save your biggest smiles for the shitheads, and don't take your eyes off theirs. The women will think you love their earrings. The men will think you're smitten with them. None of them will know that you're actually watching their every move.
Ready for the biggest joyride of your life, Senator?
Winston asks as the elevator begins its slow 400-foot trundle up the side of the rocket.
Ready, ready, Teddy,
Gwendy says, giving him the wide smile she reserves for shitheads.
How about you?
Totally excited,
Winston proclaims. He spreads his arms, and Gwendy has to take a step back to keep from being bopped in the chest. Gareth Winston is prone to expansive gestures. He probably feels that being worth $120 billion, not as much as Jeff Bezos, but close, gives him the right to be expansive.
Totally thrilled, totally up for it, totally stoked.
He is, needless to say, the paying passenger. And in the case of spaceflight, that means paying through the nose. His ticket was $2.2 million, but Gwendy knows there was another price as well. Mega billions translates into political clout. And as it gears up for a manned Mars mission, Tet Corp needs all the political allies it can get. She just hopes Winston survives the trip and gets a chance to use his influence. He's overweight, and his blood pressure at last check was borderline. Others in the Eagle crew may not know that, but Gwendy does. She has a dossier on him.
Does he know she knows?
It wouldn't surprise Gwendy in the least.
To call this the trip of a lifetime would be an understatement, he says.
He's speaking loudly enough for the others to turn around and look. Operation Commander Kathy Lundgren gives Gwendy a wink, and a small smile touches the corners of her mouth. Gwendy doesn't have to be a mind reader to know what that means.
Better you than me, sister.
As the slow-moving elevator passes the lower T in Tet, Winston gets down to business. Not for the first time, either.
You're not here just to send back rah-rah dispatches to your adoring fans, or to look down at the big blue marble and see how the fires in the Amazon are affecting wind currents in Asia.
He looks meaningfully down at the white box with its classified stamp.
Don't sell me short, Gareth. I took meteorology classes in college and boned up all last winter,
Gwendy says, ignoring both the comment and the implied question. Not that he's afraid to ask outright. He already has, several times, both during their 4 weeks of pre-flight training and their 12 days of quarantine.
It turns out that Bob Dylan was wrong.
Winston's broad brow creases.
Not sure I'm following you, Senator.
You actually do need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. The fires in the Amazon and those in Australia are making fundamental changes in Earth's weather patterns. Some of those changes are bad, but some may actually be working in the environment's favor, strange as that seems. They could put a damper on global warming.
Never believed in all that stuff myself. Overblown at best, non-existent at worst.
Now they are passing the E. Get me away from this guy, Gwendy thinks. Then realizes that if she didn't want to be in close quarters with a guy like Gareth Winston, she should have avoided this trip altogether. Only she couldn't. She looks up at him, maintaining what she thinks of as the Patsy Follett smile. Antarctica is melting like a popsicle in the sun, and you don't think global warming is real? But Winston won't be led away from what interests him. He may be an overweight blowhard, but he didn't make all those mega billions by being stupid. Or distractible.
I would give a great deal to know what's in your little white box, Senator, and I have a great deal to give, as I'm sure you know.
Ooh, that sounds suspiciously like a bribe.
Not at all, just a figure of speech. And by the way, since we're going to be space mates very shortly, can I call you Gwendy?
She maintains the brilliant smile, although it's starting to hurt her face. By all means. As for the contents of this, she lifts the box. Telling you would get us both in very big trouble, the kind that lands you in a federal facility, and it's really not worth it. You'd be disappointed, and I'd hate to let down the fourth richest man in the world.
Third richest,
he says, and gives her a smile that equals Gwendy's in brilliance. He waggles a gloved finger at her.
I won't give up, you know. I can be very persistent. And no one is going to put me in prison, dear.
Oh my, Gwendy thinks. We've progressed from Senator to Gwendy to dear in the course of one elevator ride. Of course, it's a very slow elevator.
The economy would collapse.
To this, she makes no reply, but she's thinking that if the box inside the box, the button box, fell into the wrong hands, everything would collapse. The sun might even gain a new asteroid belt between Mars and Venus. Chapter 4. At the top of the gantry, there's a large white room where the space travelers stand, arms raised and doing slow pirouettes, as a disinfecting spray that smells suspiciously like bleach wafts over them. It's their last cleansing. Not long ago, there was another room in here, a small one, with a sign on the door reading, "Welcome to the last toilet on Earth." But Eagle Heavy is a luxury liner equipped with its own bathroom, which, like the three cabins, is actually little more than a capsule. One of the private cabins is Gareth Winston's. Gwendy reckons he deserves it. He paid enough for it. The second is Gwendy's. Under other circumstances, she might have protested this special treatment, U.S. Senator or not, but considering her main reason for being on this trip, she agreed. Mission Control Director Eileen Braddock suggested that the six members of the crew without flight responsibilities, Ops Commander Kathy Lundgren and Second Ops Sam Drinkwater, draw straws for the remaining cabin, but the crew voted unanimously to give it to Adesh Patel, the entomologist. His live specimens have already been loaded. Adesh will sleep in a cramped bunk surrounded by bugs and spiders, including, oh, ag, Gwendy thinks, a tarantula named Olivia and a scorpion named Boris. The lavatory belongs to all, and no one is any happier about that than their mission commander. No more diapers, Kathy Lundgren told Gwendy during quarantine. That, my dear Senator, is what I call one giant leap for mankind, not to mention womankind. Ingress, the loudspeakers on mission control boom. T-minus 2 hours and 15 minutes, green across the board. Kathy Lundgren and Second Ops Sam Drinkwater faced the other members of the crew. Kathy, her auburn hair sparkling with tiny jewels of disinfectant mist, addresses all eight, but it seems to Gwendy that she pays special attention to the senator and the billionaire. Before we begin our final prep, I'll summarize our mission's timeline. You all know it, but I am required by Tet Corp to do this once more prior to entry. We will achieve Earth orbit in 8 minutes and 20 seconds. We will circle the Earth for 2 days, making either 32 or 33 complete circumnavigations, the orbits varying slightly to create a Christmas bow shape. Sam and I will be charting space junk for disposal on a later mission. Senator Peterson, Gwendy, will begin her weather monitoring activities. Adesh will no doubt be playing with his bugs. General laughter at this. David Graves, the mission's statistician and IT specialist, says, "And if any of them get free, out the hatch they go, Adesh, along with you." This provokes more laughter. To Gwendy, they sound pretty loosey-goosey. She hopes she sounds that way herself. On day 3, we'll dock with many flags, which just now is pretty much deserted except for a Chinese enclave.
"Spooky,"
Winston says, and makes an ooh sound. Kathy gives him a flat look and continues. The Chinese keep to themselves in Spoke 9. We are in Spokes 1, 2, and 3. Spokes 4 to 8 are currently not occupied. If you see the Chinese at all, it will be while they're running the outer ring. They do a lot of that. You'll have plenty of room to spread. We're going to be up there for an additional 19 days, and room to spread is an incredible luxury, especially after 48 hours in Eagle Heavy. Now here comes the important part, so listen to me carefully. Burns Stapleton is a veteran of 2 previous trips. Dave Graves has made 1. Sam, my second in command, has made 5, and I've made 7. The rest of you are newbies, and I'll tell you what I tell all newbies. This is your final chance to turn around. If you have even the slightest doubt about your ability to pull your weight from ingress to final egress, you must say so now. Nobody speaks up. Kathy nods. Outstanding. Let's get this show on the road. One by one, they cross the access arm and are helped into the spacecraft by a quartet of white-suited and disinfected service personnel. Lundgren, Drinkwater, and Graves, who will be overseeing the flight from a bank of touchscreens, go first. Below them, on the second level, Dr. Dale Glenn, physicist Reggie Black, and biologist Byrne Stapleton seat themselves in a row. On the third and widest level, where eventually more paying passengers will sit, or so TechCorp hopes, are Jafari Benkole, the astronomer who'll have little to do until they're in the MF station, entomologist Adesh Patel, passenger Gareth Winston, and last but not least, the junior senator from Maine, Gwendy Peterson. Chapter 5. Gwendy seats herself between Benkole and Patel. Her flight chair looks like a slightly futuristic Lazy Boy recliner. Above each of them are 3 blank screens, and for a panicky moment, Gwendy can't remember what they're there for. She's supposed to do something to light them up, but what? She looks to her right in time to see Jafari Benkole plugging a lead into a port in the chest of his suit, and things come into focus. Keep it together, Gwendy. She plugs in, and the screens above her first light up, then boot up. One shows a video feed of the rocket on its launch pad. One shows her vital signs, blood pressure a little high, heart rate normal. The third shows a rolling column of information and numbers as Becky, Eagle Heavy's computer, runs an ongoing series of self-checks. These mean nothing to Gwendy, but presumably they do to Kathy Lundgren. Also to Sam and Dave Graves, of course, but it's Kathy, plus Eileen Braddock, the mission control director, who will be watching the readouts with the greatest attention, because either one of them can scrub the mission if they see something they don't like. That decision, Gwendy knows, would cost upwards of $17 million. Right now, all the numbers are green. Above the marching columns is a countdown clock, also in the green. "Hatch closed," Becky tells them in her soft, almost human voice. "Conditions remain nominal. T-minus 1 hour, 48 minutes. "Downrange check," Kathy says from 2 levels above Gwendy. "Weather downrange," Becky commences. "Belay that, Becky." Kathy can't turn her head much because of her suit, but she waves an arm. "You give it to me, Gwendy." For a terrible moment, Gwendy has no idea what to do or how to respond. Her mind is a mighty blank. Then she sees Adesh Patel pointing below her seat, and things click into place again. She understands that stress is making her condition worse and tells herself again that she has to calm down. Must. She's a lot less terrified about sitting on megatons of highly combustible rocket fuel than she is of the relentless neurological decay going on in the gray sponge between her ears. She grabs the iPad out of its clips beneath her seat, Peterson stamped on the cover. She thumbprints it and swipes to the current weather app. The cabin's superb Wi-Fi overrides the diagnostic screen above her. What takes its place is a weather map similar to one on a TV newscast. "It's grand downrange," she tells Kathy. "High pressure all the way, clear skies, no wind." And she knows it would take hurricane-force winds to knock Eagle Heavy off course once it was really rolling. Most weather concerns have to do with liftoff and reentry. "How about the up above?" Sam Drinkwater calls back to her. There's a smile in his voice. "Thunderstorm 70 miles up, with a slight chance of meteor showers," Gwendy returns, and everyone laughs. She turns off her tablet, and the diagnostic screen resumes. Jafari Bankole says, "If you would like the porthole seat, Senator, there is still time for us to switch." There are two portholes on the third level, again with an eye to future tourism. Gareth Winston, of course, has one of them. Gwendy shakes her head. "As the crew astronomer, I think you should have an observation post. And how many times have I told you to call me Gwendy?" Bankole smiles. "Many. It just does not come naturally to me." "Understood. Appreciated, even. But as long as we're crammed together in the world's most expensive sardine can, will you give it your best shot?"
"All right. You are Gwendy, at least until we dock with the Many Flags station."
They wait. The minutes drain away, the way my mind is draining away, Gwendy can't help thinking. At T-minus 40, Becky tells them the service structure is retracting on its gigantic rails. At T-minus 35, Becky announces, "Fuel loading has commenced. All systems remain nominal." Once upon a time, actually just 10 or 12 years ago, but things move fast in the 21st century, the fuel was loaded before the human cargo, but SpaceX changed that. And a lot of other things. There are no more flight controls, just the ubiquitous touchscreens. And Becky is really running the show. Gwendy just hopes the Bexter isn't a female version of HAL 9000. Lundgren and Drinkwater are basically just there for what Kathy calls the dreaded holy shit moment. Dave Graves is actually more important. If Becky has a nervous breakdown, he can fix it. Probably. Hopefully. "Helmets," Sam Drinkwater says, putting on his. "Let me hear your Roger." One by one, they respond. For a moment, Gwendy can't remember where the catches are, but then it comes to her and she locks down. T-minus 27, Becky informs. "Systems nominal." Gwendy glances at Winston and is meanly pleased to see that some of his rich guy bonhomie has evaporated. He's looking out his porthole at blue sky and a corner of the mission control building. There's a red patch on the fleshy cheek Gwendy can see, but otherwise he looks pale, maybe thinking this wasn't such a good idea after all. As if catching her thought, he turns to her and gives her a thumbs up. Gwendy returns the gesture.
"Got your special box all secure?" Winston asks.
Gwendy has it beneath one knee, where it won't fly away unless she does, and she's secured with a 5-point harness like a jet fighter pilot.
"Good to go."
And then, although she's no longer sure what it means, if it means anything,
5x5.
Winston grunts and turns back to the window. On her left, Adesh has closed his eyes. His lips are moving slightly, almost certainly in prayer. Gwendy would like to do the same, but it's been a long time since she had any real confidence in God. But there is something. That she's sure of. Because she cannot believe that any power on Earth made the strange device currently hidden inside a steel container that can only be opened with a 7-digit code. Why it has ended up in her hands again is a question to which she supposes she knows the answer, or at least part of it. Why she's saddled with it while suffering the first stages of early onset Alzheimer's is less understandable. It's also hideously unfair, not to mention absurd. But since when did questions of fairness ever enter into human events? When Job cried out to God, the Almighty's response was mighty cold. "Were you there when I made the world?" Never mind, Gwendy thinks. Third time is the charm. Last time pays for all. I'll do what I have to do, and I'll hold on to my mind long enough to do it. I promised Ferris, and I keep my promises. At least, she always has. If not for the innocent people with me, she thinks. For the most part, good people, brave people, dedicated people, maybe with the exception of Gareth Winston. I'd almost wish we'd blow up on the launching pad or 50 miles downrange. That would take care of everything. Except it wouldn't. That's something else that's slipped her increasingly unreliable mind. According to Richard Ferris, the author of All Her Misery, it wouldn't take care of everything any more than weighting the goddamned button box down with rocks and dropping it into the Marianas Trench would take care of everything. It had to be space. Not just the final frontier, but the ultimate wasteland. Give me strength, Gwendy prays to the god whose existence she highly doubts. As if in response, Becky, the god of Eagle Heavy, tells them they are now at T-minus 10 minutes, and all systems remain green. Sam Drinkwater says, Visors down and locked, let me hear you, Roger. They snap down their visors, firing off their responses. At first, everything looks dark to Gwendy, and she remembers her polarizing visor also came down. She shoves it up with the heel of her gloved hand. Initiate oxygen flow, let me hear you, Roger. The valve is somewhere on her helmet, but she can't remember where. God, if only she could get to her notebook. She looks at Adesh in time to see him twist a knob on his helmet's left side, just above the pressure suit's high collar. Gwendy copies him and hears the soft shush of air into her helmet. Remember to turn it off once we achieve orbit, she tells herself. Cabin air after that. Adesh is giving her a questioning look. Gwendy makes a clumsy O with her thumb and forefinger. He gives her a smile, but Gwendy is afraid he saw her hesitation. Again, she thinks of her mother's NG. Not good. Chapter 6. Time in training has been slow. Time in quarantine has been slow. The walk out, the elevator ride, the insertion, all slow. But as those last earthbound minutes begin, time speeds up. In her helmet, too loud, and Gwendy can't remember how to turn it down, she hears Eileen Braddock in Mission Control say, T-minus 5 minutes, terminal countdown begins. Kathy Lundgren, Roger that, Mission Control, terminal countdown. Use your iPad, Gwendy thinks. It controls everything in your suit. She touches the suit icon, finds the volume control, and uses her finger to decrease the blare. See how much you remember, she thinks. He'd be proud. Who would be proud? My handsome hubby. She has to fish for his name, which is appalling. Ryan, of course. Ryan Brown is her handsome hubby. Sam Drinkwater. Eagle is in auto idle. All fuel is on. On her iPad and on the screen above her, T-minus 3 minutes gives way to 2:59 and 2:58 and 2:57. A gloved hand grips hers, making Gwendy startle. She looks around and sees Jafari. His eyes ask her if it's okay or if she'd like him to let go. She nods, smiles, and tightens her grip. His lips form the words, all will be well. Winston has his bought-and-paid-for portal, but it's going to waste, at least for now. He's staring straight ahead, his lips pressed so tightly together that they're almost not there, and Gwendy knows what he's thinking. Why did this seem like a good idea? I must have been crazy. Kathy. Arm for launch? Sam. Roger that, armed for launch. 11 minutes from stars in the daytime, folks. Seemingly only seconds later, Eileen from Mission Control. Crew okay? Let me hear you, Roger. One by one, they reply. Gareth Winston is last, his Roger a dry croak. Kathy Lundgren, sounding as cool as the other side of the pillow. Flight termination armed? T-minus 1 minute. Are we go for launch? Sam Drinkwater and Eileen Braddock answer together. Go for launch. With the hand not holding Jafari's, Gwendy feels for the steel box. It's there. It's safe. Only the box inside it is not safe. The box inside is the most dangerous thing on Earth, which is why it must leave Earth. Eileen Braddock. First stops, Commander Lundgren, you have the bird. Roger that, I have the bird. On the screen above Gwendy, the final 10 seconds begin to count off. She thinks, what is my name? Gwendy. My father wanted a Gwendolyn, and my mother wanted a Wendy, like in Peter Pan. They compromised. Hence, I am Gwendy Peterson. Gwendy thinks, where am I? Playa Linda, Florida, the Tet Corporation's launch complex, at least for a few more seconds. Why am I here? Before she can answer that question, a vast rumble begins 450 feet below where she sits reclined in her ergonomic chair. Eagle's cabin begins to vibrate, gently at first, then more strongly. Gwendy has a fragmentary memory of being 5 or 6 and sitting on top of their washing machine as it goes into its final spin cycle. We are firing green, Sam Drinkwater says. A second or two later, Kathy says, lift off. The roar is louder, the vibration more intense. Gwendy wonders if that's normal or if something has gone wrong. On the center screen above her, she now sees Mission Control and the rest of the complex through a red-orange bloom of fire. How far below is it? 50 feet? 100? A shudder runs through the craft. Jafari's grip tightens. This isn't right. This can't be right. Gwendy closes her eyes, asking herself again why she's here. The short answer is because a man, if he is a man, told her that she had to be. At this moment, waiting for her life and all the others to end in a vast explosion of cryogenic liquid oxygen and rocket-grade kerosene, she can't remember the man's name. A crack has opened in the bottom of her brain, and everything she has ever known has started to leak into the darkness below it. All she can remember is that he wore a hat, small and round, black. Chapter 7. This is the third time the button box has come into Gwendy Peterson's life. The first time, it was in a canvas bag with a drawstring top. The second time, she found it in the bottom drawer of a filing cabinet in her Washington, D.C. office. During her freshman term as Maine's 2nd District Representative, that was. The third time was in 2019, while she was running for the Senate. A campaign that Democratic committee insiders felt had as much chance of succeeding as the charge of the Light Brigade. Each time, it was brought by a man who always dressed in jeans, a white shirt, a black suit coat, and a small bowler hat. His name was Richard Ferris. On the first occasion, the button box was in her possession all through her adolescence. On the second, her custodianship was much shorter, but she believed it saved her mother's life. Alicia Peterson died in 2015, years after cancer should have killed her. The third time was different. Ferris was different. Gwendy retired from the House of Representatives in 2012, although she could have gone on getting elected well into her 80s, perhaps even into her 90s if she had so chosen. You're like Strom Thurmond, Pete Riley, head of the Maine Democratic Committee, once told her. You could have gone on getting reelected even after you were dead. Please, no comparisons to that guy, Gwendy had said. Okay, how about John Lewis? Whoever you use for a comparison. Hell, Margaret Chase Smith from right up the road in Skowhegan spent 33 years in D.C. The point is the same. You're the fabled automatic, and we need you. But what Gwendy needed to do was write books. Fiction was her first love. She had published only 5 novels, and time was marching on. Retirement from public service opened up that side of her life and made her happy in a way life under the Capitol Dome never had. She published Bramble Rose in 2013, and then in 2015, a serial killer novel called Desolation Street. That one, featuring a charming maniac who harvested the teeth of his victims, was set in D.C. but based on certain events in her hometown. She was considering another book, one full of romance and family secrets, when Donald Trump was elected president. Many in Maine's 2nd District rejoiced, feeling the Washington swamp would be drained, the budget would be balanced, and the flood of bad hombre, illegal immigrants from South America, would finally be dammed up. For lifelong Democrats, the kind of people who avoided Fox News as if it might give them rabies, it was the beginning of a 4-year nightmare. Gwendy's own father, perhaps the most apolitical member of the Democratic Party in the entire state of Maine, looked at Gwendy with sober eyes the day after the election and said,
"This is going to change everything, Gwenny, and probably not in a good way."
She was deep into the novel, this one set in Maine at the time of the Bradley gang massacre in Derry, when Pete Riley came to see her again. The poor man looked as if he'd lost 20 pounds between election night in 2016 and that early winter day a little over 2 years later. He kept it simple, and he kept it brief. He wanted Gwendy to run against Paul McGowan for the Senate in 2020, which he called the year of perfect eyesight. He said only Gwendy would have a chance of beating the Republican businessman who expected his campaign to be little more than a formality on the way to a foregone conclusion.
"If nothing else, you could slow his roll and give some hope to all the good folks suffering TD."
"Which is what?"
"Trump depression."
"Come on, Gwendy, open your mind to this. Give it fair consideration." Fair consideration was one of her trademark phrases, used at least once at every town hall gathering during her political career. If Pete expected it to turn the key in her lock, he was disappointed.
"You're joking. You have to be. Aside from the fact that I'm writing a new book,
and I'm sure it will be as good or better than the others," Pete said, flashing his most winning Clark Gable smile.
"Don't bother blowing smoke up my skirt," Gwendy said, who that day was wearing a pair of old Levi's.
"Better men than you have tried and failed.
What I was going to say is that aside from the new book, where there's a lot of hot sex that I'm enjoying vicariously, that idiot McGowan won by 15 points in 14. And after spending 2 years with his lips firmly attached to Donald Trump's ass, he's got an 80% approval rating."
"Bullshit," Pete said. "Republican propaganda, you know it is."
"I know nothing of the kind, but let's say it is. I was quite popular during my run in the House, I'll give you that, but memories are short. McGowan is the man of the hour, and I'm the woman of yesterday. There's a tide in politics, and right now it's running strong conservative. You know that as well as I do. I probably wouldn't lose by 15 points, but I'd lose."
Pete Riley went to the window of Gwendy's small study and looked out with his hands stuffed deep in his pockets.
"Okay," he said, not looking at her. "Barring a miracle, you'd lose. I think we've settled that point. So lose. Make a pretty concession speech about how the voters have spoken, but the fight continues and blah, blah, blah. Then you can go back to writing about Derry, Maine in the 1930s. But this isn't the 30s. It's 2018, and you know what?"
He turned back to her like a good defense attorney addressing the jury.
"Yates's blood-dimmed tide is also running. People are turning away from women's rights, from science, from the very notion of equality. They're turning away from truth. Politics aside, somebody needs to stand up and make them look at all the stuff it's easier and more comfortable not to believe in. You always did that. Always. I'm asking you to do it again. To be your noble Joan of Arc and let the good people of Maine burn me at the stake?
Nobody is going to burn you alive," Pete said,
not knowing that 8 years later, Gwendy would be atop a flaming torch called Eagle Heavy and more than half expecting to be transformed into superheated atoms at any moment.
"You're going to lose an election. But in the meantime, you could make that fat prick McGowan sweat bullets. Get him on the debate stage and make people see that he's sticking up for ideas that aren't just bad, they're unworkable and downright dangerous. Then you can go back to writing your books."
Gwendy had been ready to be angry with Pete, but she saw he was at least partly right. She was being melodramatic, which, she supposed, went with writing fiction full of secrets and hot sex. "Take one for the team, in other words. Would that be accurate?" He gave her the big Clark Gable grin.
"Hole in one."
"Let me think about it," she'd said. "Probably a mistake." Chapter 8. "But not as big as this one," Gwendy thinks, as the roar of the engines increases to a bellow. Jafari Bencole's grip has become paralyzing, even through the thickness of their two gloves. She goes to Crew on her iPad with her free hand, highlights Jafari's name with the pad-sensitive tip of her index finger. It's easier to remember stuff when you're not trying, she has discovered, and speaks to him calm to calm, so it's private.
"Let up a little, Jeff, okay? You're hurting."
Sorry, he says, and relaxes his grip.
This is such a very long way from Kenya.
And from Western Maine, Gwendy says. The cabin's shutter shake begins to lessen, and her recliner starts to turn slightly on its gimbals. Or is it? Maybe what's really happening is that the altitude of the cabin is changing. Tilting. Gwendy punches for OpsCom so she can listen to Kathy, Sam, and Mission Control.
350 miles downrange, and the sound barrier is just a happy memory, Eileen says.
She sounds calm, and why not? Eileen is safe on the ground.
Roger that, Kathy says. She also sounds calm, which is good.
Looking fine, Eagle Heavy. Nominal burn, all three engines.
Roger. Sam Drinkwater this time. The cabin's tilt is gradually becoming more pronounced, and the ride has become smooth. For the time being, at least.
You are a go for throttle up, Eagle Heavy.
Kathy and Sam together.
Roger.
Gwendy can't hear any real difference in the engine roar, but an invisible hand settles on her chest. Ahead of her, Dale Glenn, the mission's doctor, appears to be making notes on his iPad. And never mind the pad-sensitive fingertip, he has stripped his glove off. He could be in his Missoula consulting room, Gwendy thinks. She goes to flight info on her pad. They are less than 2 minutes into the flight, but already 22 miles high and traveling at 2,600 miles an hour. For a woman who considers driving at 80 on the Maine State Turnpike living dangerously, she finds the number hard to comprehend, but there is no doubt about the increasing pressure on her body. Gravity doesn't want to let go. There's a thud, followed by a bright flash in the porthole to her left, and for a moment she thinks it's all over. Jafari's hand clamps down again.
Solid booster rocket has separated, Sam says, to which Dave Graves responds, Hallelujah, swivel those jets, Bo Peep.
Call me that again and I'll tear your face off, Kathy says. Let me hear your Roger.
Roger that, Dave says, grinning.
The tilt of the cabin increases. Outside, the blue sky has darkened to violet.
Three main engines all firing beautifully, Kathy says. And Gwendy sees Burn Stapleton lift his hands with the thumbs up. A moment later, he's in her helmet, calm to calm.
Enjoying the ride, Senator?
And because for a moment it's just the two of them, she says.
Best orgasm a girl ever had.
He laughs. It's loud. Gwendy winces. She needs to turn down the sound, but how does she do that? She knew a little while ago, she even did it, but now she can't remember. It's on your iPad. Everything is. Before she can turn down the volume, Byrne has clicked off and OpsCom returns. Below, and now far behind, Eileen Braddock is telling them they've passed the point of negative return. Kathy.
Roger that, negative return.
No going back now, Gwendy thinks. And her fear is replaced by a feeling of what-the-hell exultation that she never would have expected. Space or bust. She motions for Jafari to raise his visor, and she raises her own. Not protocol, but it's only for a few seconds. And she has something she wants to say. Needs to say.
Jaff, we're going to see the stars.
The astronomer smiles.
God's grace, Gwendy. God's grace.
Chapter 9. After Pete Riley's visit, Gwendy began to read up on Paul McGowan, the Republican junior senator from Maine. The more she read, the more disgusted she became. The younger Gwendy Peterson would have been outright horrified, and even at 58, with several trips around the political block in her resume, she felt at least some horror. McGowan was an avowed fiscal conservative, declaring he wouldn't allow tax-and-spend progressives to mortgage the futures of his constituents' grandchildren. But he had no problem with clear-cutting Maine's forests and removing the commercial fishing bans in protected areas. His attitude seemed to be that the grandchildren he was always blathering about could deal with those things when the time came. He promised that with the help of President Trump and other friends of the American economy, he was also going to get Maine's textile mills running again, from Kittery to Fort Kent. He waved aside such issues as acid rain and polluted rivers, which had given up such wonders as two-headed salmon in the mid-20th century when the mills had been booming 24/7. If he was asked how the product of those mills could compete with cheap Chinese imports, McGowan told voters,
We're going to ban all Chinese imports except for Mushu pork and General Tso's chicken.
People actually laughed and applauded this cod swallop. While she was watching that particular video on YouTube, Gwendy found herself remembering what Pete Riley had said on his exploratory trip in December of 18.
People are turning away from women's rights, from science, from the very notion of equality. They're turning away from truth. Somebody needs to stand up and make them look at all the stuff it's easier not to believe in.
She decided she was going to be that somebody, but when Pete called her in March of 2019, she told him she still hadn't decided.
Well, you better hurry up, Pete told her. It gets late early in politics, as you well know. And if you're going to take a shot at this, I want to be your campaign manager. If you'll let me, that is.
With that smile of yours, how could I say no? Gwendy asked.
Then I need to start positioning you.
Ask me again in April. Pete made a low moaning sound, as if she'd stepped on his foot.
That long?
I need to deliberate and talk to my husband, of course.
Although she was pretty sure she knew what Ryan's reaction would be.
What she needed to do was to finish her book, City of Night, a title already used by John Ritchie, but too good not to use again, and clear the decks. Then she was going to go after Senator Paul McGowan with everything she had. As someone with absolutely no chance of winning, she felt good about that. When she told Ryan, he reacted pretty much as she had expected.
I'm going to go out and buy a bottle of wine. The good stuff. We need to celebrate. Ladies and gentlemen, Gwendy Peterson is back.
Chapter 10. Outside the porthole nearest to Gwendy, the sky is now dark. More than dark.
Blacker than a raccoon's asshole, Ryan might have said.
The cabin rotates further, her chair compensates, and all at once her three monitor screens are directly ahead of her instead of over her head. The roaring of the engines stops, and all at once Gwendy is floating against her 5-point restraining harness. It reminds her of how it feels when a roller coaster car takes its first dive, only the feeling doesn't stop.
Crew, helmets can come off, Sam says. Unzip your suits if you want to, but keep them on for now.
Gwendy unlocks her helmet, takes it off, and watches it float, first in front of her and then lazily upward. She looks around and sees three other helmets floating. Gareth Winston snatches his down.
What the hell do I do with it?
He sounds shaky. Gwendy remembers this, and Winston should. God knows they had enough dress rehearsals. Reggie Black says,
Under your seat, your compartment, remember?
Right, Winston says, but doesn't add a thank you. That doesn't seem to be in his vocabulary. Gwendy stows her helmet, opening the hatch by feel and waiting until she hears the small click as the helmet's magnetized circle finds the corresponding circle on the side of her personal stowage area, which is surprisingly large. There's also room for her pressure suit when the time comes, but for the time being, the only thing she wants to put in there is the steel box with its dangerous cargo. She takes it from beneath her knee, places it in the compartment, and discovers she has to hold it down so it won't float back up like a helium balloon.
Steel floats, she marvels. Holy God, I'm in a place where steel floats.
Senator Peterson, Kathy calls. Gwendy, come up here. I want to show you something. Do you remember how to move around? She doesn't. It's gone. It shouldn't be, but it is. Reggie Black, the mission physicist, bails her out.
One or two slow strokes, he says.
Easy, so you...
Now she remembers.
So I don't bump my head on the destruct button.
A joke they learned in training.
Exactly so, Adesh says, beaming. Must not bump that one, no.
Winston says nothing. Gwendy can see he's miffed not to have been invited up top first. He is, after all, the paying passenger. The guy may be worth an obscene amount of money, but with his lower lip stuck out the way it is now, he looks like a petulant child. Gwendy unbuckles and laughs when she rises slowly from her seat. She pulls her knees up to her chest as she was taught during training and goes into a lazy forward roll. She extends her legs. She could be lying on her stomach in bed, except of course there is no bed. And she doesn't have to stroke. Jafari closes his hand around her ankle and gives her a gentle push. Laughing, delighted, she floats toward the top of the cabin,
only it's now the front of the cabin, over the heads of Reggie, Byrne, and Dr. Glenn. It's like being in a dream, she thinks. She grabs the back of David Graves' seat and pulls herself in between Kathy and her second-in-command, whose name has slipped her mind. It's something about water, but she can't remember what. There are no portholes in the control area, but there's a narrow slit window, 4 feet long and 6 inches wide. You can see this better on your center screen, Kathy says quietly, and of course on your tablet, but I thought you might like your first look this way, since you're part of the reason these missions are still flying. I had my own reason, Gwendy thinks. Space exploration, advancing human knowledge, sure, but now there's something else. For one horrifying moment, she can't remember what that something else is, even though it's the biggest thing in her life. Then that concern is driven from her mind by what she's seeing below her. And yes, it's definitely below. The home world hangs in the void, blue-green and wearing many scarves of white cloud. She has seen pictures, of course, but the reality, the first-hand reality, is staggering. Here, in all the black nothing of empty space, is a world teeming with improbable life, beautiful life, lovely life. That's the Pacific Ocean, the second-in-command says quietly, and now that she's not trying, she can remember his name, Sam Drinkwater. How can America be gone so fast, Sam?
Speed will do that. Hawaii just passing below us. Japan coming up.
She can see a whirlpool down there, white, twisting away in the middle of the blue, and remembers the monsoon she saw while checking the weather dump on her computer early that morning when she couldn't sleep. But this is no computer screen. This is a God's eye view. Pure beauty is what it is, she responds to Sam, and begins to cry. Her tears rise and hang above her, perfect floating diamonds. Chapter 11. Of course, the opposition was laying for her. They could do that because Gwendy was the only viable candidate for the Democratic nomination. She announced her intentions in August of 2019 with her husband by her side. She spoke from the Castle Rock bandstand on the town common, where she'd announced her candidacy for the House of Representatives each time she ran. There were reporters and camera crews from all the main television stations in attendance, plus bloggers and even a national guy, who probably just happened to be in the area, Miguel Almaguer from NBC News. There was also an excellent turnout of locals who cheered their fannies off. Gwendy even spotted some homemade signs. Her favorite, waved by her old friend Bridget Desjardins, read, "Hey Maine, Sendy Gwendy." The coverage of her speech was good. Local NPR stations ran the whole 10 minutes that night. Paul McGowan's comment on the late news was typically condescending. "Welcome to the race, little lady. At least you'll have your books to fall back on when it's over." The McGowan campaign would hold most of its advertising for another full year, because Mainers don't really get interested in the local races until 3 or 4 months before the election. But they fired an opening salvo on August 27th, the day after Gwendy's announcement. Full-page newspaper advertisements and 60-second TV spots began with the statement that Maine's favorite writer is running for the United States Senate. Printed below it in the newspaper ads and narrated on TV for the Reading Challenged was a selection from Bramble Rose, published in 2013 by Viking. Gwendy was sourly amused by the portentous tones of the narrator in the TV ad. Andrew embraced her from behind with one hand planted firmly on her bare midriff. With his other, he stroked her bleep until she began to breathe hard. "I want you to bleep me now," she said, "and don't stop until I bleep." He carried her to the bedroom and threw her down on the four-poster. Panting, she turned on her side and grasped his bleep, breathing, "Now, Andy, I can't wait any longer." Below this in the print ads, and across an especially unflattering picture of Gwendy in the TV ads, mouth open, eyes squeezed half shut, looking mentally disabled, was a question. Isn't there already enough pornography in Washington? Gwendy was amused by the sheer scurrilousness of this attack. Her husband was not. "You ought to sue them for defamation of character.
Ryan said, throwing down the Portland Current in disgust. Oh, they'd love me to get down in the dirt with them, Gwendy said. She picked up the newspaper and read the excerpt. Do you know what this proves?
That McGowan will stoop to anything?
Ryan was still fuming. That he's low enough to put on a tall hat and crawl under a rattlesnake? That's good, but not what I was thinking of.
It proves that context is everything. Bramble Rose is a better book than this suggests. Maybe not a lot, but still.
When asked about the so-called pornography in the weeks that followed, Gwendy responded with a smile. Based on Senator McGowan's voting record, I'm not sure he could tell you the difference between porn and politics. And since we're on the subject of porn, you might want to ask him about his pal Donald Trump's romance with Stormy Daniels. See what he's got to say about that. What McGowan had to say about Stormy Daniels, it turned out, was not much. And eventually the whole issue blew away, as teapot tempests have a way of doing. Both campaigns dozed as the autumn of 2019 burned away Indian summer and brought on the first cold snap. McGowan might bring back the carefully culled passage from her book when the election run started in earnest, but based on her sharply worded retort, he might not. Gwendy and Ryan helped serve Thanksgiving dinner that year to 100 homeless people at the Oxford Street shelter in Portland. They got back to Castle Rock late, and Ryan went right to bed. Gwendy put on her pajamas, almost got in beside him, then realized she was too wired to sleep. She decided to go downstairs and have a juice glass of wine, just two or three swallows to calm the post-event jitters she still felt, even after years in the public eye. Richard Ferris was sitting in the kitchen, waiting for her. Same clothes, same round black hat, but otherwise how he'd changed. He was old and sick. Chapter 12. When Gwendy turns around to stroke her way back from officer country to the crew's launch area, she almost bumps heads with Gareth Winston, who is floating just behind her.
Make way for the big fella, Senator.
Gwendy turns on her side, grabs a handhold, and pulls herself back to her seat while Winston crams between Graves and Drinkwater. He peers out through the slit for a few moments, then says,
Huh, view's better from the porthole.
Enjoy it, then, Kathy says. Suggest you let those who don't have a porthole come up and have a peek.
Dave Graves is checking a run of computer figures and murmuring with Sam, but he takes a moment to give Gwendy a look, eyebrows waggling. Gwendy isn't sure he's communicating 3 weeks with this guy should be fun, but she's pretty sure that's what it is. Gwendy has met plenty of rich people in Washington. They are attracted to power like bugs to a bug light, and most of them are pretty much okay. They want to be liked. She thinks Gareth is an exception to the general rule. She grabs her seat back, does a neat little twist, in zero G, her 64-year-old body feels 40 again, and settles in. She buckles her harness and unzips her suit to the waist. She takes her notebook from the elasticized pocket of her red eagle jumpsuit, not because she needs it at this moment, but just to verify it's there. The book is crammed with names, categories, and information. Some of it she doesn't need yet, but she's read enough about what's wrong with her to know she will as the mental rot in her brain advances. 1223 Carbine Street. Her address. Pippa. The name of her father's aging dachshund. Homeland Cemetery, where her mother is buried. A list of her medications, presumably now stored in her tiny cabin along with the scant wardrobe she was allowed to bring. No telephone numbers, her iPhone won't work up here, although Eileen Braddock assured her such service was only a year or two away. But a complete list of her phone's functions, plus a list of her duties as Eagle's weather officer. That may be a make-work job, but she intends to do it well. The most important thing in her memory book, that's how she thinks of it, is halfway through, written in red ink and boxed, 1512253. It's the code that opens the otherwise unopenable steel case. The idea of forgetting that number and thus find herself unable to get to the button box inside fills Gwendy with horror. Adesh has pulled himself over to look out of Winston's porthole, and Jafari Benkole is looking over his shoulder. There's currently no earth to look at from that one,
but Dr. Glenn has pulled himself down to look out the other side.
Amazing. Amazing! It's not like looking at photos or even film footage, is it?
Gwendy agrees and opens her notebook to the crew page because she has forgotten the doc's first name.
Also, Reggie Black, what's his job? She knew only minutes ago, but it slipped away.
A feather floats up from her book. Winston, now swimming his way back, reaches for it.
Don't touch that, Gwendy says sharply. He pays no attention, simply plucks it out of the air, looks at it curiously, then hands it to her.
What is it?
A feather, Gwendy says, and keeps herself from adding, Are you blind? She has to live with this man, after all, and his support of the space program is vital. If they find signs of life in the solar system, or beyond, that might not be the case. But for now it is.
I use it as a bookmark.
Lucky charm, perhaps?
The shrewdness of this startles her and makes her a little uneasy.
How did you guess?
He smiles.
You have the same feather tattooed on your ankle. Saw it in the gym while you were on the treadmill.
Let's just say I like it.
Winston nods, seeming to lose interest.
Gentlemen, may I have my seat back and my porthole?
He puts a slight but unmistakable emphasis on my. Adesh and Jafari move out of his way, a couple of swimming trout making way for an overfed seal.
It's marvelous, Adesh murmurs to Gwendy.
She nods. Once she's got some clear space to maneuver, Gwendy releases her harness again and takes off her pressure suit. She does an involuntary forward roll in the process and thinks that weightlessness isn't all it's cracked up to be. Once the suit is stowed under her seat, folded on top of the steel case, she descends to the next and last level down, which will be the passenger common room on later orbital flights, and perhaps on flights to the moon. Such an amenity is brand new, and it won't be there on craft that go directly to the MF station. This is its maiden run. The area is shaped like a great big contact capsule, and surprisingly roomy. There are two large view screens set into the floor, one showing empty black space, and the other featuring the vast shoulder of Mother Earth with its gauze of atmosphere. Faintly dirty, Gwendy can't help but notice. Two of the cabins are on the port side, the other and the head on the starboard. The shiny white doors can't help but remind her of morgue lockers on some of the TV crime shows she enjoys. A sign on the toilet says, Always review procedure before operating. Gwendy doesn't need the John yet, so she gives a lazy kick of her feet and floats to the cabin with Sen Peterson on the door. The latch is like the one on a refrigerator. She pulls it and uses the grip over the door to yank herself inside. The cabin, actually more of a nook, is also in the shape of a cold capsule, but much smaller. Claustrophobic, really. This time she's reminded of the crew quarters in World War II submarine films. There's a bunk with a harness to keep the sleeper from floating up to the curved ceiling a foot or so above, a minuscule fridge big enough for three or four bottles of juice or soda, maybe a sandwich if you really crammed, and, of all things, a Keurig coffee maker. Coffee in your cabin, she thinks, the height of space travel luxury. On top of the tiny fridge, held in place by a magnet, is a steel-framed photograph of Gwendy and Ryan and her parents. The four of them on the beach at Reed State Park, laughing with their arms around each other. Gwendy will soon start her weather duties, but for now she needs to mentally refocus and review the crew information. She lies down on her bunk and buckles herself in. Servos are humming somewhere, but otherwise her little cold capsule is eerily silent. They may be circling the planet at thousands of miles an hour, but there's no sense of movement. She opens her red notebook and finds the crew pages. Names and thumbnail bios. Reggie Black is the physicist, of course he is. And Dr. Glenn's first name is Dale. Easy peasy, clear as a freshly washed window. But it could be gone again in an hour, maybe just 15 minutes. I'm crazy to be here, she thinks. Crazy to be covering up what's wrong with me. But he gave me no choice. It has to be you, Gwendy, he said. I have no one else. So I agreed. In fact, I was sort of excited by the prospect.
Only then I was all right, Gwendy whispers. At least I thought I was. Oh God, please get me through this. Here in the up above, after what she has seen below her, Earth so fragile and beautiful in the black, it's easier to think he or she might really be there.
Chapter 13. What? Gwendy began, meaning to finish with either, are you doing here, or is wrong with you? She didn't know which, and Ferris didn't give her time. He put a finger to his lips and whispered, hush. He lifted his eyes toward the ceiling. Don't wake your husband. Outside. He struggled to his feet, swayed, and for a moment she was sure he was going to fall. Then he caught his balance, breathing hard. Inside his cracked lips, and were those fever blisters on them? She saw yellowish teeth, plus gaps where some were missing.
Under the table. Take it. Hurry. Not much time.
Under the table was a canvas bag. She hadn't seen that bag since she was 12, 45 years ago, but she recognized it immediately. She bent down and picked it up by the drawstring top. Ferris walked unsteadily to the kitchen door. There was a cane leaning beside it. She would have expected such a fabulous being, someone straight out of a fairy tale, to have a fabulous walking stick, maybe topped with a silver wolf's head, but it was just an ordinary cane with a curved handle and a scuffed rubber bicycle grip over the base. He leaned on it, fumbled for the doorknob, and almost fell again. Black suit coat, black jeans, white shirt. Those garments, which had once fitted him with casual perfection, now bagged on him like cast-off duds on a cornfield scarecrow. She took his arm, so thin under the coat, to steady him, and opened the door herself. That door and all the others were locked when she and Ryan left, and the burglar alarm was set. But now the knob turned easily, and the alarm panel on the wall was dark. Not even the message, waiting, in its window. They went out on the screened back porch, where the wicker furniture hadn't yet been taken in for the cold season. Richard Ferris tried to lower himself into one of the chairs, but his legs wouldn't cooperate, and instead he just dropped, letting out a pained little grunt when his butt hit the cushion. He gasped a couple of times, stifled a cough with his sleeve, which was caked with the residue of many previous coughs, then looked at her. His eyes were the same, at least. So was his little smile.
We need to palaver. You and me.
It wasn't what he'd said the first time she met him. Close, but no cigar. Back then he'd said they ought to palaver. Needing to, she thought, takes it to a whole new level. Gwendy shut the door, sat down in the porch swing with the canvas bag between her feet, and asked what she would have asked in the kitchen had he not reminded her that she had a husband upstairs. What's wrong with you, and why are you here? He managed a smile.
Same Gwendy. Right to the point. What's wrong with me hardly matters. I'm here because there's been what that little green fellow Yoda would call a disturbance in the Force. I'm afraid I must ask you.
He began to cough before he could finish. It racked his thin body, and she thought again how like a scarecrow he was, now one blown about on its pole by a strong autumn wind. She started to get up.
I'll get you a glass of wa- No. You won't.
He brought the spasm under control. Coughing that hard should have raised a flush in his cheeks, but his face remained dead pale. His eyes were set in dark circles of sick. Ferris fumbled in his suit coat and brought out a bottle of pills. He started to cough again before he could get the cap off, and the bottle dropped from his unsteady fingers. It came to rest against the drawstring bag. Gwendy picked it up. It was a brown pharmacy bottle, but there was no information on the label, just a series of runes that made her strangely dizzy. She closed her eyes, opened them again, and saw the word Dinusha, which meant nothing to her. The next time she blinked, the dizzying runes were back. How many? He was coughing too hard to reply, but held up two fingers. She pushed the cap off and brought out two small pills that looked like the Ranexa her father took for his angina. She put them in Ferris's outstretched hand, There were no lines on it. The palm was perfectly smooth. And when he popped them in his mouth, she was alarmed to see tiny beads of blood on his lips. He swallowed, took a breath, then another, deeper one. Some color bloomed in his cheeks, and when it did, she could see a little